So that leads us then to chapter 25, which is the opposite process. We've been talking about glycogenolysis. Now we want to talk about glycogenesis, production of glycogen, which, being in the opposite process, of course, is going to be called for in the opposite situation. You know, you wouldn't want to run two opposite pathways, one of which undoes the other at the same time. We've already talked about that in terms of glycolysis versus gluconeogenesis. You don't do them both at the same time, right? So something that acts as a signal that means it's appropriate to do one can also act as a signal that says it's not appropriate to do the other. And therefore, just like when we talked about glycolysis and gluconeogenesis, we're going to talk about reciprocal control of glycogenolysis versus glycogenesis. So this is glycogenesis that we're talking about now, production of glycogen. And in this first slide, we see a major player in the game. We've actually already encountered this molecule. This is uridine diphosphate glucose, or UDP glucose. Where have we already talked about this? Exactly, metabolism of galactose. In the glycolysis chapter, we talked about glucose being the main fuel, right? But it's not the only sugar that can feed into the glycolytic pathway. Remember when we talked about galactose being another common hexose that can feed right into it? But to do that, we needed this UDP glucose to shuffle things around so that we could transform galactose into glucose effectively. Well, this is another use of this same molecule. And it's called UDP glucose because it's simply a glucose in blue connected to a UDP, a uridine diphosphate. UDP in black by itself is simply a nucleoside diphosphate, right? It's a nucleoside diphosphate because it's a nucleoside connected to two phosphates, and it's the reason it's a nucleoside is for the same reason that adenosine is, right? A nitrogenous base connected to a pentose sugar. It's just, in this case, it's not it's not adenine that is the nitrogenous base. It's uracil instead. So uracil and the pentose sugar together make up the nucleoside called uridine instead of adenosine. So the black thing is uridine diphosphate. We hook a sugar onto it, or glucose onto it, it's UDP glucose. Slide 2. This shows you how UDP glucose is formed. And I still haven't told you why we need UDP glucose. It is acting as an activated sugar, an activated carrier of glucose, so that it can be added one glucose residue at a time to a growing glycogen molecule. So we're going to need it to do the job of polymerizing glucose into glycogen. But to get it, we need to go through this little reaction shown on slide 2. Notice that it involves interaction between glucose 1-phosphate and UTP, uridine triphosphate. All right? Well, for some reason, this book chose to skip a couple steps and go straight to formation of UDP glucose, which is actually okay because it gives me a chance to quiz you a little bit. Where does glucose 1-phosphate come from? Now, if you think about glycogen production, the original raw material is glucose, right? So if you have plenty of glucose on hand, that's time to produce glycogen. And one way you can have plenty of glucose on hand is that you have plenty of it coming in through the gut because you just ate. Right? So right after a meal, right after that meal is absorbed, which is not right after the meal, but after some digestion takes place, the blood glucose level spikes, or it starts to spike, and then the body responds to that, right? By the way, what does the body do as a response? Right. The pancreas hears about this spike in glucose levels, and it responds by releasing insulin, which is opposite in effect compared to glucagon, right? Insulin assists the cells of the body in taking glucose up from the blood into themselves, right? So that's the original raw material, just glucose, plain old glucose, not phosphorylated glucose. What do the cells of the body, though, do with that glucose as it comes into them? They phosphorylate it, exactly. Producing what? Glucose 6-phosphate, not glucose 1-phosphate. What is it that helps them phosphorylate glucose into glucose 6-phosphate? Hexokinase for most tissues, including skeletal muscle, which is the first glycolytic pathway enzyme, right, that we've already talked about. Seems like a long time ago now. The liver has hexokinase as well, but remember, the liver has a different enzyme that does the same job. In other words, it has an isozyme. What is that called? Does the same thing as hexokinase. It transforms glucose into glucose 6-phosphate. Glucokinase, good. As you would expect for isozymes, even though they do the same job, they don't do it in exactly the same way. What is the difference between glucokinase and hexokinase? No, they both do. They both make glucose 6-phosphate. Well, let me give you a half answer. Glucokinase has a higher Km than hexokinase. What does that mean in terms of kinetics? It means that it takes a higher concentration of glucose in order for a lot of it to be transported. I mean, in order for a lot of it to be phosphorylated into glucose 6-phosphate. So this is appropriate for the liver because the rest of the tissues are taking in glucose for their own use because it's available in the blood. Liver is taking what's left over basically so that it can store glycogen for the rest of the body later. But they do the same job. That gets us glucose 6-phosphate. Well, that's still not on this slide, right? So we need something that transforms glucose 6-phosphate into glucose 1-phosphate. And we've already talked about that. What is that? Phosphoglucomutase, exactly. Acting as a mutase, all it does is take the phosphoryl group from the sixth position, put it onto the first position. So, we've talked about those enzymes before, and that's probably why the book just skips those steps, but that's actually considered part of glycogenesis as well. That will get us the glucose 1-phosphate that we need here in order to build the main activated glucose, which is UDP glucose. And we do that by combining glucose 1-phosphate with uridine triphosphate. And all that's happening here is that the two black phosphates, which are the terminal two of the three that UTP are carrying, get cleaved off in this process so that glucose 1-phosphate with its pink phosphate will be hooked via that phosphate to the remaining blue phosphate. Once the two black ones leave, that will give you UDP glucose. But the two phosphates that are cleaved off are still connected together. They're just no longer associated with a carbon skeleton. That's why they are abbreviated PP sub I. Inorganic, what does the PP stand for? Pyrophosphate, right. Orthophosphate is a single phosphate on its own, inorganic. Pyrophosphate is two inorganic phosphates stuck together. And notice this is a highly reversible reaction. By the way, before I forget to tell you the enzyme name, the enzyme responsible for this is UDP glucose pyrophosphorylase, named for those products when we're going in this right direction. Okay? But it's a highly reversible reaction if you're trying to accomplish glycogenesis, creation of glycogen. Then you don't want it to go back and forth, right? You want it to proceed in the direction to the right. Well, it does so. And it does so because as soon as this pyrophosphate is produced, it's going to be hydrolyzed into inorganic phosphate. Orthophosphate, individual phosphates on their own rather than pyrophosphate. Now, the reason that's going to cause this reversible reaction to just go to the right instead of right and left is because you're removing pyrophosphate from the right side of the reaction. In other words, the hydrolysis of pyrophosphate is going to force this reaction to the right because of Le Chatelier's principle. Right? You take away a product, that's going to force the system to respond by producing more product to undo that perturbation in the system. And the reason that's so important is because it gives me a chance to say Le Chatelier's. So now we have UDP glucose, and we can go to slide 3 and see what it does. Like I said, the UDP glucose is really an activated glucose. It's an activated subunit for the production of glycogen. And here we're actually assuming that we already have some glycogen made. This is just showing you how the glycogen molecule is enlarged once it's there. So you already have some number, N residues of N glucose residues in an overall glycogen molecule of whatever size, and we're just adding another glucose to it. Well, glycogenesis is really just the reverse of glycogenolysis, except that, as you should expect by now, it's really not just the same pathway using the same enzymes running in reverse. But in terms of what is done, it is the reverse. Just like glycogenolysis could pick off glucose residues only from the non-reducing ends, the tips of these branches, glycogenesis can only put new glucose residues onto those non-reducing ends. Does the reverse of picking them off, in other words. And that's what we have here on the left side of this glycogen, end residues of glycogen, that hydroxyl that's stuck to that C4 in the ring, that's the non-reducing end. Okay? That's where we add this pink, brand new glucose being carried by UDP. And when that happens, the UDP is now on its own. This is just UDP, not UDP glucose. And now we have a glycogen molecule that is N plus 1 residues big. We've added another glucose. All right, well, that still doesn't answer the question of how we start. Yeah, go ahead. For this, yes, especially because we'll talk a lot more about it. What enzyme is responsible for doing this? Anyone know? Yes, glycogen synthase, which is aptly named. It's synthesizing glycogen, right? Glycogen synthase is the main enzyme, but it's just not the only enzyme involved in the process. We've already talked about some, right? But glycogen synthase is the main enzyme, doing most of the work, in a sense, just like glycogen phosphorylase is the main enzyme doing most of the work in dismantling the glycogen molecule in glycogenolysis. All right, well, in slide 4, we're seeing the same picture that we've looked at in the previous chapter. This is a fairly small, new glycogen molecule. It hasn't gotten very big yet. And I already told you what this G stands for in the previous chapter. Anyone remember? Glycogenin, yes. Glycogen, even though glycogen as an overall molecule is considered to be a polysaccharide, it isn't, strictly speaking, purely a polysaccharide because there is a protein component necessary to get the process of building the polysaccharide started. In other words, glycogenin as a protein acts as a primer, just like you need primers in DNA synthesis. You need those RNA primers in order to have something to build on so that DNA polymerase can come around and do its job and adding DNA nucleotides one at a time. Same thing's happening here, except that in DNA synthesis, those RNA primers are eventually replaced. Not so in glycogen. In glycogen, the protein component, which is the glycogenin, stays there for the lifetime of that glycogen molecule. Now, glycogen is not only a protein, it's specifically an enzyme. And it's a homodimer. Which, what does that tell you? Two subunits and what else? They're the same thing. They're just two copies. So one glycogenin is two identical polypeptides. Each one of those polypeptides has catalytic activity. And when the one subunit acts as an enzyme, it uses the other subunit as a substrate. So what each subunit of glycogenin does as its own enzyme is to stick glucose residues on to the other subunit. And so each of those is doing that to each other for a certain number, 10 or so glucose residues. That gets you the primer that you have to have. And you have to have this primer, by the way, because the glycogen synthase enzyme, the main one that makes the whole glycogen molecule bigger, one glucose residue at a time, that can't start from scratch. It can only add glucose residues onto a string that is a certain number of glucose residues long. So it has to have something to start with, and that's what glycogenin is all about. Now, this actually is a misdrawn picture, in a sense, because this shows you just one oligosaccharide sticking off of the protein G. I just told you, though, that it's a homodimer, and each one is sticking glucose residues onto the other. So really, there should be two things symmetrically coming off of this. And other drawings will show it that way. But this is just simpler to think about. Anyway, there would be two of these that are now long enough, have enough glucose residues in each one, so that the other enzyme, glycogen synthase, can come along and make them longer still by one glucose residue at a time. All right, well, that doesn't tell us anything about the branching, though. That would just make it two longer and longer strands. But we already know that glycogen is highly branched. So that's going to be another enzyme we need to talk about. In slide 5, we have a rundown of what we have so far. Glycogenin... acting as it's not only as a component of the glycogen, but also as an enzyme to get its creation started, will form the core attached to the core. Actually, here represents the glycogenin itself, the protein component. But because of its catalytic activity, it adds a certain number of glucose residues in yellow, hooked together via alpha-1-4 glycosidic linkages. So that UDP glucose brings in a new glucose one at a time, and under the catalysis of glycogen synthase, will add that glucose to this growing chain, forming new alpha-1-4 linkages one at a time. This will get you a longer and longer strand. But once this thing gets long enough, and only when it gets long enough, will the glycogen branching enzyme come in and do its job, which is exactly the reverse of the debranching enzyme. It cleaves off, in this picture, 7 blue... It's not necessarily 7, but in this picture it's these 7 blue residues that are at the end of the growing chain. Cleaves those off from the rest of the chain and then sticks it on as a branch of that chain farther back, making an alpha-1-6 glycosidic linkage, just like we've already talked about when we dismantled the glycogen molecule. All right? So that's why it's called the branching enzyme, because a branch branches off using a 1-6 linkage, not a 1-4. Well, now you have two ends that are non-reducing, the main strand and the branch, and UDP glucose can bring new glucose in one at a time with the help of glycogen synthase to keep adding these until they're longer. Once they're longer, then each one of those will branch using this branching enzyme again. And so roughly every 10 glucose residues, you have a branch. Now that's important for a couple reasons. Glycogen having so many branches in it gives it a lot more opportunity to interact with water. In other words, it makes it much more soluble, which is important for its efficient storage. But when it comes time to use it from storage, in other words, when it's time to mobilize glucose and undergo glycogenolysis, the high degree of branching also helps for that. The more branches you have, the more tips you have. Remember that you can only take things off of the tips. If you had an enormously long chain, say it has 30,000 glucoses in it, but it's just one chain, and that's a reasonable number of glucose residues that you'll find in a big glycogen molecule. Well, it's going to be slow to mobilize that because you can only take it off one at a time from the only end you're able to do in just a single strand. But with a lot of branches, you can simultaneously be taking them off of many tips and therefore mobilize the glucose very quickly. All right. The rest of the chapter is about the control of this. That really is all there is to the pathway. Like I said, it's pretty much the reverse of glycogenolysis, just using a different set of enzymes. Now we'll talk about the control, and some of what we already learned about the control in glycogenolysis will come back into play here. This is slide 6. Well, this should look pretty familiar to you. We just talked about it today, part of it at least. This is the G-protein-coupled receptor that can receive either glucagon or epinephrine from outside of the cell. This is in response to exercise or fasting. Exercise produces epinephrine. Fasting produces glucagon. Anyway, we've already talked about this activated G protein activating adenylate cyclase, which activates ATP, converts ATP into cyclic AMP. Cyclic AMP activates protein kinase A. Remember, green on all of these means the active form of this thing. Protein kinase A now can act as a kinase. Well, we already talked about the fact that phosphorylase kinase gets phosphorylated by protein kinase A, right? That's going to make it into the active form of phosphorylase kinase, which of course phosphorylates phosphorylase, turns that into phosphorylase A, the active form, which does its job of breaking down glycogen to liberate or mobilize glucose. Right? That's all from last chapter. What we didn't talk about is that protein kinase A, as this versatile signal or intermediary, can phosphorylate other things as well. The arrow to the right of this same protein kinase A molecule that's now activated shows that it is it's also phosphorylating glycogen synthase kinase, which is not glycogen synthase, right? Glycogen synthase kinase is the enzyme that phosphorylates glycogen synthase. Just like phosphorylase, glycogen synthase has both A and B forms, and just like for phosphorylase, the A form is the more active form. But since phosphorylase, which operates in glycogenolysis, and glycogen synthase, which operates in glycogenesis, are used for opposite purposes, there better be something in this that they are different about, that's different about them, right? The thing that's different is that phosphorylase, the glycogenolysis enzyme, is active in its phosphorylated state. So when you phosphorylate phosphorylase, you turn it from B to A and you make it active. Glycogen synthase, in its phosphorylated state, is the inactive form. You turn A into B when you phosphorylate glycogen synthase. So the same signal, which results through these steps in the same protein kinase A being produced, will result in the phosphorylation and therefore the activation of phosphorylase, which turns on glycogenolysis, at the same time that the protein kinase A phosphorylates glycogen synthase kinase, so that it will phosphorylate but therefore turn off glycogen synthase, because the phosphorylated version of glycogen synthase is the inactive form. And therefore, while glycogenolysis is turned on, glycogenesis is turned off. Yeah?
So both from B to A, one down, one down.
Right. For both of them, they have A and B forms. For both of them, the A is the active form. But for the glycogenolysis enzyme, the A form is phosphorylated. So phosphorylation turns it on. For glycogen synthase, the glycogenesis enzyme, the phosphorylated version is inactive, so phosphorylating and turns it off. The same signal will turn one on at the same time it turns the other one off, which is exactly what you would want to have happen if you don't want to run both of these processes at the same time, which you don't want to, right? You don't want to build glycogen at the same time you're tearing down glycogen. You're just going to waste some energy because you do have to spend some ATP to build the glycogen. Okay? This is an example of what's called reciprocal coordinate control. It's reciprocal because what's done to the one pathway is the opposite of what's done to the other pathway. Well, only one is on at one time. They're not both on at the same time. All right, on to seven. This flow chart shows you, well, notice the condition up in the upper left, after a meal or during rest. After a meal or during rest, a meal is going to bring in a bunch of glucose. Rest is not going to demand glucose for the muscles. So in both of these cases, in either or both of these cases, it would be an appropriate situation to use glucose to make glycogen to store it for later when you actually do need that extra glucose. Okay? So this is a situation that calls for glycogenesis and therefore does not call for glycogenolysis. Well, I don't know whether you can tell from where you are, but the bottom part of this flow chart is not in black, it's in gray. This is the part that we just looked at. The bottom part of this, which is controlled by glucagon or epinephrine, that's the situation that calls for glycogenolysis. That's being turned off right now, which is why the book dimmed it into gray. Instead, the stuff on the top is happening. All right, glycogen synthesis is required in this. It's called for after a meal or during rest. And protein phosphatase 1 comes into play here. It's another versatile enzyme. But first, recall that phosphatases in general are enzymes that dephosphorylate, whereas kinases in general are enzymes that phosphorylate. So protein kinase A and protein phosphatase 1 are just specific examples of enzymes that do opposite jobs. And it should make sense that they are controlling two opposite pathways. Okay? So the protein kinase A here is turned off. Protein phosphatase 1 is turned on. What does protein phosphatase 1 do? Well, it dephosphorylates, but specifically, it can dephosphorylate phosphorylase, glycogen phosphorylase. Remember, that's the enzyme for glycogenolysis. You're trying not to break down your glycogen at the moment, you're trying to build new. So you turn off the enzyme responsible for dismantling glycogen, for glycogenolysis. That enzyme is phosphorylase. And when you remove the phosphates from it, you transform it from the A, the active form, into B, the inactive form. Okay, that shuts down glycogenolysis. But also, this same protein phosphatase 1 can dephosphorylate phosphorylase kinase. Remember that phosphorylase kinase is more active when it's phosphorylated. So when protein phosphatase 1 dephosphorylates phosphorylase kinase, it can no longer do its job of phosphorylating phosphorylase, turning B back into A. So you turn A into B, and you also don't let B be turned back into A by phosphorylase kinase, because you've dephosphorylated it. Does that all make sense? The third, the rightmost arrow here, the same protein phosphatase 1 enzyme, is dephosphorylating glycogen synthase. But remember, in this case, dephosphorylation will turn it on. Glycogen synthase gets activated when it loses its phosphorals. So now you're in the green version of glycogen synthase, exactly what you want when you want to build a glycogen molecule. Now you can build one up, but you've turned off phosphorylase, so you're not going to tear it down at the same time. All because of this same protein phosphatase 1 enzyme. So this is part of this coordinate control. A single signal will affect both pathways, but in opposite ways at the same time. All right, 8. Now a little bit more about protein phosphatase 1, which is the blue thing here, PP1. It is possible for it to be associated with a kind of a scaffolding protein, a subunit called G sub M, if it's the version that we find in muscles. The G here stands for glycogen, because glycogen can bind there, and the M for muscle. You'll find a similar one in liver called G sub L, but right now we're in muscle. And this is during exercise or fasting. During exercise or fasting, you would want glycogenesis or not? Right, you don't want it during exercise or fasting because you need the glucose at that time. You don't want to put it into storage, you want to use it. Well, remember that protein phosphatase 1, according to what happened in the last slide, will turn on glycogenesis. So if you don't want glycogenesis, you better turn off protein phosphatase 1. That's what's happening here. All right? Notice that protein phosphatase 1 is associated with just G sub M. Okay? Now, in response to epinephrine or glucagon, which we've already discussed, have the effect of calling for glycogenolysis and therefore trying to turn off glycogenesis, what happens is that protein kinase A, the same one we've been talking about, will allow for the phosphorylation of this G sub M subunit. You can see the phosphate stuck onto it now on the bottom. And that dissociates it from protein phosphatase 1. Now you have the blue on its own, but since the protein phosphatase 1 is no longer bound to the G sub M subunit, that means it underwent a shape change, right? Because when things combine to proteins, a shape change occurs. The shape change is such in protein phosphatase 1 that it makes it less active, just for that reason alone. And that's partway to our goal, right? Because we're trying to turn off protein phosphatase 1 so that we turn off glycogenesis. It's not completely inactivated, though. We have this green thing to come into play as well, which is an inhibitor. And there are many different kinds of inhibitors that can work the same way in different tissues. But that same old protein kinase A at the top is also able to phosphorylate an inhibitor molecule. And in the phosphorylated version, that inhibitor molecule will fit right into the active site of protein phosphatase 1, inhibiting it. So now we have protein phosphatase 1 completely shut off. It's not just shut down, it's inactivated. That's exactly what we want when we don't have extra glucose and we need glucose from the glycogen stores that have already been stored. We don't want to keep putting it into storage. That all make sense? All righty. Let's go to 9 then. Yeah. If you inhibit protein phosphatase 1, which is what was happening, that is going to inhibit glycogenesis. And at the same time, it's going to allow for glycogenolysis, which is appropriate under exercise because you need glucose for the fuel. You don't have extra glucose to store. All right, slide 9. Yet another signal transduction pathway to look at here. And just as I had hoped you remembered the basics of G-protein-coupled transduction, I also hope you remember the basics of receptor tyrosine kinases. Do you remember these? The insulin receptor that we see here, which is the combination of the blue and the pink, is just one example of a receptor tyrosine kinase. It's a versatile kind of receptor, but as you'd expect for any kind of receptor, it's specific for a certain signal. So this is the insulin version. Go ahead. Receptor tyrosine kinase. And it's called that because there are tyrosines in the intracellular component. Notice that in general, not just this insulin one, but a receptor tyrosine kinase is a transmembrane protein complex. It goes all the way through the thickness of the membrane, which is important. You have to have that if your signal doesn't enter the cell, right? Otherwise, the inside of the cell can't tell the something's happening outside. You have to have something stick all the way through the membrane, just like for a G-protein coupled receptor. Anyway, in general, a receptor tyrosine kinase is called this because the outside portion, the extracellular part of the protein, acts as a receptor. It has a specific receptor site that allows for a specific type of ligand acting as a signal to bind to it. That's the receptor part of the name, but it's called a receptor tyrosine kinase because the intracellular part of it, the pink part in this part, in this cartoon, has a bunch of tyrosine residues in it. Tyrosines are just amino acids, right? The whole thing is made of amino acids. But the tyrosine residues become phosphorylated. That's in response to the reception of the signal outside the cell. So this is in general how a receptor tyrosine kinase works. When the signal reaches the outside part, the change in conformation that results when that ligand binds to the receptor is going to change the shape. The shape change that results is going to change the shape of the entire protein, not just where the outside part is. So the inside part is going to change shape as well, which allows for the phosphorylation of tyrosine residues in the pink part. What happens is that one half of it is going to phosphorylate the other half and vice versa, kind of like we were talking about with glycogenin, only with phosphorylation. Once those tyrosines are phosphorylated, then that activates them as enzymes that can phosphorylate something else that's already in the cell. And so that is common to all receptor tyrosine kinase receptors. The only thing that's different is the specific type of signal. In this case, it's insulin. All right? Well, the second part, once you have these tyrosines phosphorylated and you've activated the receptor, in other words, the second part in this specific pathway that we're talking about is that these IRS molecules become phosphorylated. Remember, I said that the receptor tyrosine kinase itself becomes phosphorylated as part of its activation. That you don't see that detail right here. But that activation then makes them kinases that can phosphorylate still other things. In this case, those other things that the tyrosine kinase is phosphorylating are these IRSs, which stands for insulin receptor substrates. Okay? That makes sense, right? This receptor tyrosine kinase, the big blue and pink thing, is the insulin receptor. When it becomes activated as a kinase as an enzyme has a substrate. Those substrates are called, in this case, insulin receptor substrates. So they are proteins that become phosphorylated when insulin activates the receptor tyrosine kinase, the insulin receptor. Then there's several other steps that are just not even shown here. They just put three arrows there. But once again, we have a signal transduction cascade. So each step along the way allows for amplification of the signal. And then certain kinds of protein kinases are activated. Protein kinase is not the only kinase. There are other protein kinases that that we see here. And the job of those, of course, is to phosphorylate something. In this case, it's glycogen synthase kinase. Glycogen synthase kinase in the unphosphorylated state is the activated one. So phosphorylation of glycogen synthase kinase inactivates it. Okay? Therefore, it does not allow it to do its job of transforming glycogen synthase from its inactive to its active form. All right? Now, at the same time, let me start over. Insulin is the original signal here, right? And what do we keep saying insulin does in general? Yeah, it allows glucose to enter cells easily from the blood. Because insulin is a signal that you've been fed. It's an indicator of the fed state. So while all of this is happening as part of the control of glycogenolysis and glycogenesis, you also have, as a branch of this whole pathway, that just isn't shown on this slide, as part of this activation, this phosphorylation of the IRSs, another effect of that, separately, is to cause the cell to embed a bunch of glucose transporters into the plasma membrane that aren't normally there. When you have a glucose transporter, which is a protein, but it's inside the cell, it's like this, it's like it doesn't exist, right? Only if it's embedded in the membrane is it operating as a transporter. So these things are on hand, but then when they get the insulin signal, they're embedded into the plasma membrane, and now glucose can come in. That's how insulin operates, to allow glucose to enter the cells through these GLUT transporters that we talked about in another chapter. So separate effect of this same signal transduction pathway. Okay, now into 10. We've been talking about hormones as signals, and they're important signals, of course. But glucose itself acts as a signal, appropriately enough, because it really is all based on whether you have more glucose than you need or not enough glucose, right? As to which of these two reciprocal pathways get invoked and which one gets turned off. So you can see here in graphic form that phosphorylase in the A form, which means it's busy, is very active until you add some glucose. Glucose itself is acting as a signal that turns down the activity of phosphorylase, which takes a little bit of time. Notice the time component of the x-axis. And what's nice is that it takes about the same amount of time to tone down phosphorylase as it does to start ramping up activity of synthase. Now, if we had a different shape, if synthase started ramping up immediately, then these things would cross up here where there is appreciable activity of both of them at the same time. See what I'm saying? Then you would be undoing the two pathways, wasting energy. But because of the way this coordinate control works, synthase isn't really activated until phosphorylase is deactivated. So you're running one pathway or the other, not both at once. So then let's see how glucose itself can act as a signal. I mean, it acts as a signal also via the pancreas, as we've already talked about, because the hormones that the pancreas secretes, it does so because of the presence or absence of glucose. But glucose is actually acting even more directly as a signal here in the liver. Notice this is the G sub L, not the G sub M. So we're in the liver now. It's drawn the same way, and notice it still can have PP1 on hand. What is this other thing that we've already looked at? Well, that's phosphorylase, right? Phosphorylase is the glycogenolysis enzyme. It's the one for dismantling glycogen, right? And we would know that this is the A form even if it weren't labeled. Why is that? Because it's phosphorylated, exactly. When phosphorylase is complexed with G sub L and PP1, it's at first in this R state, which A form and R state means it's totally active, right? It's as active as it can be of the four possibilities. Well, when it's in the A form, PP1 is able to bind to phosphorylase. Okay? But when PP1, protein phosphatase 1, is bound to phosphorylase, it keeps protein phosphatase 1 inactive. All right? Now keep in mind that with the big picture that protein phosphatase 1, if it's active, is going to lead to activation of glycogenesis. Well, at the moment, we must be calling for glycogenolysis because we have the fully active form of phosphorylase. So it's appropriate that protein phosphatase 1 is shut off now. Glycogenolysis is occurring. Okay? But now you have a bunch of glucose coming into the liver. Glucose from the blood because you've just eaten recently. And here's where glucose acts as its own signal. Glycogen phosphorylase has, in addition to its other binding sites that work either by phosphorylation or allosteric modification, like we've already talked about, it also has binding sites for glucose, which are what these magenta circles are. So when glucose is now abundant, it's going to bind to those binding sites. And that's going to transform phosphorylase A from the R state, which is fully active, to the T state, which is not as active. So we're getting to where we want, right? Because when we start getting glucose, that's a signal that we should start ramping down glycogenolysis. And we should start turning on glycogenesis instead. Okay. Well, when it's in the T state, phosphorylase no longer holds on to protein phosphatase 1, which is why this whole PP1 and GL complex is no longer associated with the phosphorylase. And when protein phosphatase 1 is no longer bound to phosphorylase, it gets activated. Now it can do its job. And as a phosphatase, its job is to dephosphorylate, right? Notice the double arrow here. It dephosphorylates two different things. One thing in this picture, one thing that it's dephosphorylating is phosphorylase itself, which has already been partially turned down because it's in the R state, but it's still in the A form. Dephosphorylation via protein phosphatase 1 is going to turn it into the B state. That's going to turn it way down. Perfectly acceptable because we don't want glycogenolysis. That same PP1, though, is also going to dephosphorylate glycogen synthase. But remember, the glycogenesis enzyme, glycogen synthase, is activated when it is dephosphorylated. So dephosphorylation of glycogen synthase is going to transform it from B to A, making it active. Now it can do its job of adding one glucose residue at a time to a glycogenin core glycogen molecule. In other words, it's going to ramp up glycogenesis. And that's it. In fairly good timing. Any questions before I stop the recording? All right.